It's the NPR News Update for Monday, January 7th, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Matt Sepik in for Phil Picardi. In the news today, Minnesota legislators are getting ready for the start of the 2013 session this week, and an NPR News analysis finds the public is unable to find out a lot about their possible conflicts of interest. Bar and restaurant owners here in downtown St. Paul await the return of the Minnesota Wild, and last year's drought has dried out the soil so much that some homes in southeastern Minnesota are sinking. In other news today, two school districts in southern Minnesota added extra security today following the arrests over the weekend of a juvenile who's accused of making shooting threats. Sleepy Eye Public Schools Superintendent John Solovsky notified parents that a suspect was in custody for the alleged threats. Sleepy Eye police investigated after they were notified of a Facebook posting. The Journal of New Ulm reports public schools in New Ulm are also boosting security. In the Twin Cities, Metro Transit workers are wrapping up a vote on a new three-year contract. The Amalgamated Transit Union is still working under a contract that expired July 31st. Union leaders say the proposed contract gives workers a 2% raise in each of the next 3 years. Health benefits remain the same. Union President Michelle Summers says it's not clear how members will vote.
Turnout appears to be pretty good. So, and there's, you know, there's always comments both ways. So you never know whether going to get voted for or against.
If members don't approve the contract, Summers says the union will resume negotiations with the Metropolitan Council. The union represents about 2,200 bus drivers, train operators, and mechanics. In 2004, Metro Transit workers rejected a contract proposal and went on strike. The contract impasse between owners and players in the National Hockey League appears to be over. Over the weekend, the two sides reached a tentative agreement on a deal that, if ratified, will end this season's lockout. As Rupa Shenoy reports, many businesses near the Xcel Energy Center here in downtown St. Paul are anxiously watching the labor talks.
Just hours after the deal was announced, St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman stood inside the Xcel Energy Center, home of the Minnesota Wild, wearing a wide grin.
They've at least reached a tentative agreement. Hopefully they'll get it ratified very quickly and we'll get some hockey back in St. Paul. It's been a long time coming. We wish that this hadn't happened, but we're just glad that it's over.
The agreement still needs to be ratified by NHL owners and the union's players. Coleman says the lockout that began September 16th has crippled businesses throughout downtown St. Paul. The city has cited as evidence the last NHL lockout in 2004, which officials say sucked $60 million out of St. Paul's economy. But an NPR News analysis showed sales tax revenue actually went up slightly that season. Coleman's office has acknowledged that estimating economic impact isn't an exact science. Yet Coleman insists the lockout has been a hardship and says this NHL agreement may come just in time for downtown St. Paul.
We're fortunate that hopefully they're going to be back playing before anybody actually lost their business as a result.
Coleman says people shouldn't hold the lockout against the Wild.
It's kind of like Congress, you know, you hate the overall, you know, state of Congress, but your individual members are, you know, you still like them, right? And if you boycott the games coming back, you're only hurting the businesses that have already been struggling. So our message is, you know, let the past be the past. Hopefully we can make up on the back end with a long playoff run what we lost on the front end with the shortened season.
To that, I would say to hockey fans, if you feel like you don't want to give money to the owners, then go to the local establishments in and around the arena and watch the game from there instead of going to the game.
That's longtime Wild blogger Derek Felska of thestateofhockeynews.com. He says this proposed agreement is too little too late. Felska says many fans moved this season to minor league or college hockey that's cheaper, especially for families, and in his opinion, just as exciting. Felska spent the money that he usually puts aside for Wild games on season tickets to a minor league team in Wisconsin. He says there is a segment of Wild fans who are happy games may resume, but he says many people are genuinely angry.
Our loyalty will continue to be taken for granted if they just think we're all just going to show back up and act like nothing happened, which is what happened last time. The fans returned in droves and back in 2005, and I think they kind of banked on that happening again. But this time I think fans feel like we've been taken for granted, and the money they're talking about is our money.
Those feelings of resentment are familiar to Pat Bamer, the owner of Patrick McGovern's, which is down the street from the Xcel Center. But Bamer says he's gotten over it.
People have amnesia. they'll forget about this in 2 weeks. And people will come out and they'll support the Wild, and I think it'll be, you know, they must have probably the best team they've ever had. So with that being said, I think that, you know, they'll fill the stands. Because of the shortened season, it's actually better for me now because you know that they'll fill every game up.
Boehmer says despite the delay, he's still excited for the Wild's newest players, Zach Parise and Ryan Suter, to take the ice. NHL officials say if the tentative agreement is ratified, games may start later this month. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
To political news now, a new legislative session gets underway tomorrow in St. Paul, with Democrats running the whole show for the first time in 25 years. That means DFL Governor Mark Dayton gets to work with a DFL-controlled House and Senate that should be more receptive to his tax and spending proposals. The state budget, which shows a projected $1.1 billion deficit, will be a top priority this year. But several policy issues are also expected to get attention, as Tim Pugmire reports.
The governor's two-year budget proposal, which is due later this month, will set the stage for discussions that will last into mid-May. 2 years ago, budget disagreements between Dayton and the Republican-controlled legislature resulted in a state government shutdown. The budget was eventually balanced with a compromise that relied on one-time money, borrowing, and another delay in school payments. Dayton told reporters last month that he wants a different approach this time.
I will take on myself and I'll insist on others that we not use any, you know, one-time shifts or borrowing or gimmicks or anything else that has been used in the past to try to disguise these problems or to put them down the road. Let's deal with them now, get our fiscal house in order, and then we'll see where we go from there.
The new DFL legislative leaders appear to share Dayton's goal. House Speaker Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis said he wants a budget that provides long-term financial stability, not just another temporary fix.
I think there are going to be cuts, and whether it's reductions in the growth of spending or, you know, real cuts, that is going to be part of the budget that we put forth. I also imagine that there's going to be new revenue as part of the budget that is put forth, and I don't think Minnesotans will be surprised at that.
That new revenue will likely come through a reworking of the state tax system. Governor Dayton has said he wants to make the system fairer and simpler, and he is expected to unveil a tax reform plan this month. Dayton still supports an income tax increase on the wealthiest 2%. Republicans, who are back in the minority after 2 years of controlling the House and Senate, remain firmly opposed to tax increases. They're also busy warning about the potential for DFL overreach on the budget. Still, GOP House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd of Crown said he wants to work with the new majority.
Will the DFL overreach? My hope is not. I want to again offer my caucus and our members, we're willing to come to the table and roll up our sleeves to get to work for Minnesotans, and we want to be part of the solutions. But we're also keenly aware that they don't need our votes to do what they want to do, with the exception of the bonding bill.
GOP Senate Minority Leader David Hahn of Eden Prairie said it will be up to Democrats to decide whether they want to include Republicans in any bipartisan legislation this session. As far as the budget, Hahn said he'll urge DFL leaders to slow down the growth of state spending.
It's very, very easy for legislators to think of all the things that we can spend money on, and then they start proposing. We start proposing things, and our friends and outside groups come in and say, well, this would be good and this would be a nice thing. And next thing you know, you're looking at 10, 15, 20% growth in spending.
In November, Minnesota voters rejected a Republican-backed constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. Now, many of the people behind that opposition campaign want to see a marriage equality bill passed this session. There's deep disagreement on the subject, even among Democrats. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach of Cook said he expects a bill to be introduced and discussed, but he stressed that the budget takes priority.
I do think we still need to have a pretty significant conversation around the state on that subject. I think the conversation during the election was about whether we put it in the Constitution. It wasn't about where the public is at on the issue.
Bach also pointed out that the U.S. Supreme Court could resolve the question later this year when it's expected to rule on a pair of cases involving same-sex marriage. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. All state lawmakers who take office tomorrow are required to file an economic disclosure statement outlining the sources of their income outside the legislature. But an NPR News analysis of the disclosures by current and incoming lawmakers finds the forms provide little information that could alert the public to potential conflicts of interest. Tom Scheck has that story.
You only need to look at the current and incoming speakers of the House to see the problems with the state's disclosure requirement.
House, come to order.
Republican House Speaker Kurt Zellers lists himself as a self-employed public relations consultant on his statement. His form doesn't list his clients, and he didn't respond to questions about his work. On his statement, incoming DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen lists his job as an attorney at Lindquist and Venom, but he doesn't list his clients either. Thiessen says he works on mergers in the healthcare industry, but said the lawyer's professional code of conduct prevents him from disclosing his clients. He says he understands the public's right to know whether lawmakers have a conflict, but it's hard to balance with his regular job.
As a lawyer, I have a professional obligation to my client as well, to keep confidences, to keep privilege, you know, those kind of things. And that's it's kind of how does that interact with larger transparency to the public that we have to work through.
Thiessen says he's not an equity partner at his firm, so he doesn't share in profits. The firm also lobbies at the legislature, but he says he has no involvement with that part of the business. Thiessen also says he has and will abstain from voting on specific bills if there is a conflict of interest. He says at some point, the public has to take his and other lawmakers' word when it comes to their outside jobs.
In some sense, there has to be a level of trust, and I think that level of trust, you know, is generally appropriate.
Zellers and Thiessen are not alone in filing statements that don't give the public much real information about the sources of their outside income. One in four lawmakers filed statements that give few or no details as to where their money comes from. Some list themselves as consultants or being self-employed, but don't list any clients. Others are lawyers who work for firms or are in private practice and don't disclose their clients or what kind of cases they work on. Others told NPR News that they call themselves consultants but don't work outside of the legislature. Minnesota Campaign Finance Board Executive Director Gary Goldsmith says the law doesn't require lawmakers to disclose clients if they list themselves as self-employed. Even he admits the information is lacking.
The statements that exist now are, in many cases, not particularly helpful to the public. I think they're helpful only where the official actually makes most of his or her income from employment, W-2 type wages.
Goldsmith says the legislature will have to change the law if it wants public officials to disclose more. Some lawmakers intend to push for that change this session.
The fact that we don't require any disclosure of consulting or independent contracting is a massive loophole in the law.
DFL Senator John Marty of Roseville has been pushing to require greater disclosure from elected officials for two decades. He says in a part-time legislature where lawmakers earn $31,000 a year plus expenses, it's only natural they have other jobs.
There are going to be conflicts of interest. It may be unavoidable, but in that case, we have to make sure the public has a right to know what's going on. Who has these ties? What are the ties? And our disclosure laws are so pathetic that bottom line is you can do a lot of digging and never find the connections.
DFL legislative leaders, including Paul Thiessen, agree the disclosure law needs to be tightened. One idea being considered is to require lawmakers to list broader areas of work, like healthcare or insurance, instead of requiring a list of specific clients. But others are skeptical. Incoming Republican Senate Minority Leader David Hand says he isn't necessarily opposed to greater disclosure, but says asking consultants to provide even vague industry ties could cause problems.
Sometimes when you're a consultant, what that means is you're offering yourself as a person who's going to offer advice. And sometimes you're asked to offer advice on different things. And if you say, well, I'm going to consult on only this one topic, well, what if somebody comes along and says, well, I'd like you to consult on another topic? Does that mean you can't do that then?
Hand lists himself as a business consultant on his most recent statement. Like many other lawmakers, he didn't respond to follow-up questions about who his current and past clients are. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
We tend not to think of droughts as a wintertime problem, but in southern Minnesota, the dry conditions are causing some big problems for some homeowners. Dry soil is causing foundations to crack and homes to sink deeper into the ground. As Elizabeth Baer reports, a lack of snow in many areas this winter has locked in the drought that began last summer.
The basement of Shannon and John Cliff's home in Waseca is half living space, half den, with two bedrooms, a bathroom, and a TV area. Shannon Cliff moves from one room to another, pointing to dozens of cracks in the ceramic tiles, fissures along the walls and ceiling, and patched up gaps near the windows. She steps inside the bathroom and closes the door.
I think it fits awesome now.
That wasn't the case last July, when her youngest daughter called her to tell her she was locked inside.
We've never had doors that didn't open and shut. No one ever got locked in a bathroom. And who would have thought? I thought she was just being a wimp.
The Cliffs believe their home settled at the moment their daughter shut the bathroom door. It was one of many signs inside the house that pointed to severe problems outside. That's because the Cliffs' home sits on soil that's rich in peat moss and clay. The rainless summer drained moisture from that ground, and as the drying clay and moss shrank, a 4-inch gap started to form between the foundation and the ground. The Cliffs' house was sinking, and they quickly learned insurance would not pay for the repairs.
I cried. I'll be honest, I cried. There isn't any type of insurance that we can even buy for this. Our farmers can buy insurance for droughts and their crops, but we can do nothing for our homes.
From Rochester to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, homeowners have reported shifting foundations and cracks in basements and walls. These signs are common for aging homes, but this year's dry weather exacerbated the problem for many homeowners across the southern half of the state. Barbara Lusardi is a geologist with the Minnesota Geological Survey. She says while drought will certainly cause soils to shrink, there may be other reasons so many homes appear to be sinking.
If the house is built on an area that's been drained and filled, that could cause issues. The house construction could be a problem, depending on the time of year. If it was dry in the fall and then wet in the spring, the freezing and the thawing, the wetting and the drying of the materials can cause things to shift as well.
The sinking basements may be causing headaches for homeowners, but the conditions have been a boon for basement repair companies. Nate Proper is with Orinoco-based American Water Works. No one knows exactly how many homes have sunk, but Proper says his company alone has done 80 home repairs this year. That's 5 times more than usual. Proper says repairs vary depending on the amount of shifting that's occurred. Big problems like the Cliffs require driving long steel poles into the ground and using them to lift the foundation back into place. And that can cause other problems along the way, too.
A lot of times people beforehand have done some remodeling to cover up some of the cracks and stuff they'd seen beforehand. And now they've remodeled, on an unlevel foundation. So when you're lifting it back up, those inside building materials can try to go back to their original position, too, which could re-crack.
That's exactly what happened at the Cliffs home. The couple took $20,000 from their retirement savings to lift the foundation. Now, the house continues to settle back into place.
We watch daily for things to be going on. When the house gets quiet and you go to sleep, I listen. And where did that come from? The next day I get up and I look, okay, are we still all together?
The Cliffs hope this spring will be a wet one that brings moisture back into the ground. If that doesn't happen, they'll try running water around the foundation. But they know there's really not much more they can do to keep the ground moist. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Waseca.
And we'll end today's podcast with some positive news from the world of the arts. St. Paul's Penumbra Theater Company announced today that it has raised enough money to resume productions this spring. Because of an income shortfall back in August, Penumbra cut 6 full-time staffers and suspended all programming. Penumbra is considered one of the country's top African-American theater companies, and it's been open for 36 years. Managing director Chris Wittes says the company set a goal to raise $340,000 by the end of 2012.
We would find out whether what everyone had said all these years about their passion for Penumbra and their commitment to who we are and what we do could really be translated into dollars.
Wittes says she's humbled by the outpouring of support. More than 1,400 individuals, corporations, and foundations donated $359,000. The spring season will kick off with the production of Spunk, an adaptation of Zora Neale Hurston's Three Tales. And that'll do it for the NPR News Update for Monday, January 7th. I'm Matt Sepik. Thanks for downloading.